Hi, I'm Doc Searles. We hold a number of different hats, which will become clear in the course of this thing. This is the question. Are free customers more valuable than captive ones? It actually should not be a question at all. If we have something called free markets, we ought to have free customers as well as free sellers, and your choice should not be your choice of captor. But in fact, for the last 150 years or so, ever since industry won the Industrial Revolution, we've operated on a belief that captive customers are more valuable than free ones. And that's been a problem, especially in the internet age, which you think would relieve that. But part of the case that I want to make is that we can open up far more market opportunity by freeing customers than by capturing them. This is our hashtag, #VRM, which I'll explain in the fullness of the time that we have. And what I want to do is tell a few stories around two wrong things that we do all the time and one right thing that we don't do enough. So that's the basic outline for what I wanted to say. Wrong thing number one. So this is a view from, it's not that clear there, it's very clear on my machine, of San Francisco from Twin Peaks. San Francisco is now the northern end of Silicon Valley, where I worked for 25 years, and which in a virtual sense I still do. And I was on a balcony, and this is about 1998, 1999. This is late in the last tech boom, and I use the adjective last because we're in a tech boom again now, or a lot of us wouldn't actually be here. So it's good to know how tech booms work and learn from our experience with the last one. So I was there. I'm looking out from the balcony overlooking the city. Beautiful scene. Mostly a bunch of young people. They're all serial entrepreneurs, they call themselves. And this one guy who I knew a little bit well, he's on about his third startup. He's about 28 years old. And I ask him what you're doing, and he says, we've got a new company, and he tells me the name of it, which I've forgotten because it's now dead anyway. And he said, I asked him what they did, and he said, we're an arms merchant to the portals industry. And I said, that's interesting. Portals are an industry? He said, oh, yeah, portals are an industry. You need portals in order to aggregate all kinds of sites because the real estate language is very big back in the 90s. You know, you had sites with locations and domains that you visited and you browsed and you surfed. And so he said, what you need is you need stickiness. Sticky was very big back then. And you referred to the people who came there as eyeballs. And what you wanted to do was hold the eyeballs still with stickiness while you dumped lots of content on them and speared them with advertising. And if this sounds familiar, yes, it's still going on. So history is repeating itself, which is why it's worth visiting again. And so I asked him then what I thought was a rude question. I asked, how are sales? And he delivered to me one of the most remarkable things I've ever heard, and it has informed almost everything I've understood about business ever since. He said, sales are great. We just closed our second round of financing for $25 million. So, without any irony whatsoever, there it was. And it was such an epiphantic moment that I suddenly realized something that should have been obvious but wasn't and isn't very obvious in Silicon Valley, which is that every business has two markets. No matter what you're in, no matter what you do, you have two markets for what it is that you do. One is a market for goods and services, whatever your goods and services are, and the other one is for itself, for the company itself. And the first is to your customers, and the second is to investors. And what happened in Silicon Valley in the late 90s was number two was overrunning number one, which is why I got that answer to the question. Sales for him was selling his company to investors. It didn't matter what he did. It didn't matter what arms merchant of the portals industry was. But what happens when number two overruns number one is you get a mania, a bubble, or both. And we're in one now. We were in one then. We're in another one now. We can call it social media. We can call it a lot of other things. But it is there because it's similar. So wrong thing number two. This is Boston. Hard to tell there. But that's a view from Cambridge toward downtown Boston and the state capital there. And I was new to Boston about 5 or 6 years ago. I'd lived in a number of other places. Grew up in New Jersey. Lived many years in North Carolina. Then California, And I got a fellowship at the Berkman Center at Harvard in 2006. But I went looking for foods that I was used to in other places. So the three things that I really craved were, first, Jimmy Dean pork sausage, because I lived in North Carolina for 20 years, and I liked the basketball there, and I liked my fresh pig. And so I love my Jimmy Dean pork sausage. And the second one is, I can't do a California accent because there isn't one, except maybe Spanish. I'm not sure, but that's Cholula hot sauce. I've developed a fondness for Cholula hot sauce in California. Also there in Los Angeles, where my wife is from, La Brea Bakery bread. And it so happens that not only did I have a loyalty card for a place called Shaw's. This is it. Shaw's is a grocery store chain in Boston, in the New England area. But they happen to have those three things. Those were the reasons I stopped at Shaw's. Now I got eggs there, I got cheese there, I got other things there. But primarily I wanted those three things. Now I want you to put your big data hat on. Okay, here's somebody giving them the clues. I want to buy those things. So as you're checking out of Shaw's, and I'm doing this with a 13-year-old kid, 12, 13 years old at the time. This is it looks like a human bagging machine. You put the person at one end and they come shrink-wrapped out the other. But in fact, it is another meaning of the same thing. It's a self-checkout thing. This is the big fashion right now in retailing, especially in grocery stores and at Home Depot and places like that. It's what my wife calls outsourcing customer service to the customer. That's what you do, you know. Why should we do the work? We can offload it all to you. We will save costs that way. So, and my kid loves this because, as he explained to me recently, he is a digital native. He's come to visit us from whatever land he lives in. But he loves checking out on these things. He loves going through the ritual, which is not the same at any two of these. And you go through about 95 steps before you fail and they have to come over and help you out, right? This always happens, right? So we went through the 95 steps and which start with your scanning your little key fob that I have on my key ring for the car. And I see that I did not get the discount that really isn't, because, you know, the regular price is actually the $1.79 they want to charge you for the eggs, not the $4.99 that they're charging the people who are not members of the thing. So I go over to the customer service counter, and over the course of the next half hour, the nice woman behind the customer service counter not only fails to hack the IT system that screwed this thing up, whatever way it was, but shares with me her opinions about the system. You know, we have professionals here that can bag your groceries for you. They're trained. They know what they're doing. They won't put a gallon of milk on top of the eggs. On top of that, we hate the loyalty cards. We have to maintain multiple prices for everything. The big data we get is worthless for the most part, as you'll find out if you ever get one of our circulars. And she goes on giving me this bill of particulars about how the system doesn't work. So, and then she gives us a generous credit on a future purchase, which I put in a drawer and then forgot about. So that's how that thing works. But, you know, the net result of that, you know, is that if you look at it from the big data perspective, what did they know about me? What did they find out about me, right? So what they don't know, actually, is that I want fresh pork sausage. Even if I buy the Jimmy Dean sausage they have there, what they have is frozen. I want the thawed kind, or I want a pig that has recently been slain. That's what I'm looking for. So the second thing is I want the big bottles of Cholula hot sauce, like they sell in California. They have these little sampler bottles that are, you know, you go through pretty fast. And the third thing is I like La Brea Bakery's olive bread. And maybe they have it sometimes, maybe they don't. But my buying it alone has not given them the intelligence to find out that that's what I'm looking for. And I bring all this up because the conceit of big data today is that the guesswork mills that Google and Facebook and all these different companies are running can guess what you want better than you know yourself. That's an assumption that's going on. And it's flourishing in the absence of alternatives, which we'll visit. So this is an email that I got. You know, it's addressed to David because that's my actual name, but nobody calls me that other than my relatives. And it wants me to, you can't see it from there, but it wants me to buy some other kind of chicken sausage and a bunch of other things. There's a thing at the bottom there, you know, share this with your friends like you actually would share a coupon with your friends. Near the top is my shopping list. I don't know about you, but I've never been fond of institutions using the first-person possessive pronoun on my behalf. It's always weird. It's like, we've got your hand in your pocket. You're our puppet. This is mine. I want this, right? It's insane. So So I went, I shared this story with a friend of mine who's a professor at Harvard Business School, and he said, not so fast. Okay, look, they're not good, Shaw's. They're not as good as some other stores are. They're not doing a great job. There are stores out there that really do a very good job. Check out Stop and Shop. And it so happened I also had one of their little key fob things, because on the way home from our kids' school, there's a Stop and Shop store. And so I thought, okay, I'll go by Stop and Shop. And I've never really taken full advantage of their system there, but they have a pretty complicated system, so I thought I'd see what that was. So you go into Stop and Shop, and they have this spreadsheet of gizmos on the wall. It's a rack. It's a rack of these of scanners. And you pull a scanner out. It is now your scanner, and you put it in a holster. It is a holster provided on the shopping cart. And as you scan things, it goes into its database, and it guesses that you actually want some other stuff and offers you a discount on it. Here, save 75 cents on some kind of detergent, or you know, you can. It gives you a running total of what you've already scanned, and there's what you can add or subtract from it, and that's all very cool, I suppose. My kid, again, really loves this because he gets to run around and make the beeping sound as he does this. And at the end of it, in checking it out, there's complicated instructions for scanning it, but it's kind of interesting. You scan a barcode, and then you hang up the thing back in the spreadsheet, and then you scan your little key fob, and then you go through the whole thing, and you get your money back. And one of the interesting things is as I'm going through the store scanning this stuff, it is giving me these little real-time coupons. I think this is cool. It kind of saves me the need to give us the long strip of coupons you'll never look at for advertising they sold to suckers that you know got a coupon on the back of your receipt. But sure enough, they give me one of those. That's actually a fraction of something that's about 5 feet long. That's discounts on every kind of oil change you can possibly get in nail salons and other stuff I don't care about. But on the right was this interesting thing. They have introducing their app for iPhone and Android. We actually have one of each. That's cool. So I downloaded the app and set it up, which is really quite easy to do. And then I found that I could actually look at what my relationship with Stop and Shop was. So I'll look at three different parts of this. There's my account code. There's all these different things that they're, I don't know what's in the little ovals. There are numbers in there, but I guess those stand for discounts or points or something. I like gas points. The one that intrigued me was gas points over on the left. I didn't know whether this was a remark on the digestive effects of everything to the right, or what? Because they don't have a gas station. I mean, Stop and Shop is a grocery store. They don't sell gas. They maybe produce gas. They don't sell gas. So I didn't know what that was about, but it was intriguing. And then, you know, about a week later, I run across a Shell station that looks like it's been bought by Stop and Shop. It has, you know, this extra pole they put into the right, and whether they've got something there, they've got a banner underneath the prices. You know, they've got a thing hanging on the pump. They've got another thing hanging on the hose for the pump. They've got another thing that's actually on the front, just in case you missed it, next to the keypad. And it says, you know, enter the numbers found on the back of your key tag, which is too small for me to read, or use your larger Stop and Shop card, which I threw away because I had the key tag. So I had to punch in the tiny little numbers there. I actually had my kid punch them in or I would punch him, and he read them off for me from the thing. And when I'm done with all of this, you can't read it in the black block on the right, but this is the coolest part. It gives me this little thing. You have no Stop and Shop discounts. So what's the point, right? Why does it work this way? But about that thing lasted about 5 seconds on the little display, after which it said, and I didn't get a picture of it, but it was cool, it said, come inside and look at our 5 different Shell loyalty cards that you can get. As if one wouldn't work, right? You need 5 of these. So who would master all of this stuff other than somebody who shops only at Stop and Shop and actually gets their gas only from Shell? These are a handful of loyalty cards that one person was at a party the other night had, and I shot the picture. But these cards are stacked against us. But they're evidence of something. They're evidence of a mania that we have right now that we can actually plot across time. This is Google's Ngram viewer, which looks at the occurrence of a phrase or a word in books. And So what happened, if you look at books that mention the phrase loyalty card, it starts to pick up in the middle 90s and has peaked recently and is probably still peaking. This goes up to 2008. And I'll put this, by the way, for those shooting this, I'll put this up on SlideShare when I'm done. So, but there's clearly something that took off here. Now, look, at the coincidence is this took off when the web took off. And I think there's a case of what's called zoonosis in biology, which is the transfer of a virus from one species to another. And a weird thing that happened here was that something that was really broken on the web, that you have to log in separately, keep separate passwords for every different site, kind of fell over into the brick-and-mortar retail world, where somebody got this idea saying, you know, geez, they seem to be able to trap people into staying on websites on the web. Why don't we do that here in the brick-and-mortar world as well? Force people to carry these things around. And every one of them thinks you're their customer, you know, like you never shop anywhere else. And so the inconvenience just continues to increase. But there's a pattern here. We've been here before. I grew up in the 50s. It really looked like that. That was my father who was a carpenter, and he's got the train set. That's me with the little bib overalls on. You know, I was into electric trains, and my mom letting in the gas. But you could not buy anything anywhere in the 50s and 60s without getting a pile of S&H green stamps. The largest print run in human history was the 1966 green stamp catalog. And the idea behind them was to differentiate. We have green stamps. We give green stamps. And it turned into something that everybody had to have, just like everybody now has to have. A loyalty card. We have a loyalty card just for you. Good thing. They look like this, and there's probably lots of them now on eBay, I suppose. And this was sort of one shot that I found this morning in the early 70s when the gas crisis hit and the prices over on the right were 37 or 41 cents a gallon. The S&H green stamps easels became places to hang out your sign that says we're out of gas. And green stamps themselves ran out of gas. But if you look at this is an engram viewer of the history of green stamps. It's still being talked about in books, interestingly, probably as a historical thing, and the rise of loyalty cards. And my point here is that both these things were nuts, but they became retail manias that became so normative that nobody even questioned them. So, and they were also about capturing customers. That was the idea. So, wrong thing number two is avoiding customers and treating them like cattle, or worse. And I should say, by the way, if you listen to the language of marketing, you know, what are we trying to do? We're trying to target, acquire, manage, control, lock in, and own customers. Those are the words we use. I was talking to a guy who had worked for one of the better big box stores, and he was telling me about how we do everything we can for the customer. We call them guests. 70% of our executives are women. 70% of our customers are women. We do everything we can to own the customer. And I said, what's another word for owning a human being? And he said, oh my God, it's slavery. Why do we talk like that? I said, because you're talking to yourself. And that's what the industry's been doing for a long time. So this is especially true on the web. What happened when the web came along is that it took something that wasn't working already and made it even worse. So you'd think the web would liberate us. Not the internet. The internet is just a protocol that puts everything at zero distance from everything else. That's not, you know, the retail operations on the web, Facebook, Google, the rest of it, those are not the internet. And calling them the internet is a mistake. But what we've done by building sites that want to control us and want to provide everything they possibly can as a separate environment is taking something that that has not worked very well, or has worked too well maybe since the start of the industrial age, and kind of fixed it in place. So on the net, or on the web rather, there's an architecture. There's a technical architecture called client-server. You're the client, there's the server, right? And a friend of mine, I don't know whether this is true or not, but it makes sense, said client-server was chosen because slave-master didn't sound very good. But that's the default. So what happened when we invented the cookie and the first commercial web browsers were invented by Netscape and Microsoft in 1995 is we fixed on that and didn't change, and we haven't changed it 17 years later, Phil Windley, who I'll mention later, has a really great history of e-commerce in one slide. It says, 1995, invention of the cookie, the end. Because what happened was, what the cookie does is it allows the server to keep track of what's called state, to know where you were the last time you came. That's why when you go to Amazon, a cookie tells them, hey, we've seen you before, this is your shopping cart, we have all this knowledge of you, it's really great. And that's fine inside that system, but all the systems are separate and they're multiplying. They're like a billion different, literally, there's like a billion different commercial websites on the web now. So, but this is the system, client-server, and we're kind of fixed with that. So one really unhealthy outcome of that has been all the tracking that's going on, because this is not a mature thing. So the Wall Street Journal has this is a short URL for that, but they have a series called What They Know, a really great series that has, that started in July 2010, and they've done a bunch of research on tracking that goes on, and this is just one site, dictionary.com, that's putting in 159 cookies, 23 flash, 41 beacon, 11 first-party cookies. And the result is that we have all these sort of like little invisible dogs following us around everywhere we go. And it's because it's normative doesn't necessarily make it good, either technically or morally or for business. It's more friction. It's something that's not working very well. So one of the companies that the Wall Street Journal gave a lot of crap to over and over again in a series of articles was Rapleaf. It's a startup in San Francisco. And Rapleaf finally kind of caved on this and said, you know, we're going to talk directly to what they call consumers. And they said, our goal is to personalize your experiences. I took a screenshot here. And you can actually go in and look at what they've got on you and modify that. So I did that twice, about 6 months apart. The basic demographics they had right, my age basically, was all that mattered. But these are some of my interests. You know, I was thinking, I've got a pretty big footprint on the net. They ought to have a lot on me. I was really interested to see what they've got. What do they know, right? That's going to allow them to really target this advertising perfectly to me. So I'm into blogging, which is true. News and current events, sports and travel. This narrows me down, right? So here's, and here's the miscellaneous, right? So I completed grad school. Well, that's actually not true. Influencer score, I don't even know what that is. That's a wrong zip code. I actually corrected this earlier. They only allow you to remove it, not to actually give you the accurate zip code. You know, there are children in the household. He's off at boarding school now. He escaped. You know, they had my household income wrong. I took it out. I'm not single. And the estimated length of residence, not that it matters, was also wrong. My point here is that not only do they not have a whole lot of information, but a large percentage of it is just wrong. And an attempt to correct it on my part fails each time that I've tried it. So, and I tried it again this morning. I'm going to see where it goes. So I told you we'd do two wrong things and one right thing. Here's the one right thing. Loving your customers and letting them lead and not just follow. And so the rest of this is going to be how we do that. And so I've looked for an example of a store that does it right. And found one here with Trader Joe's. People here shop at Trader Joe's? Probably a large percentage of you do. So I'm not that into, my wife is a foodie and a gourmet, but she loves Trader Joe's. I didn't know why she loved Trader Joe's. To me, it's like, well, they got less than other stores do, and it's cheap, that's good, but I didn't know much more than that. But she loves it. And so a professor at Harvard Business School, another one, Jose Alvarez, who, by the way, ran Stop and Shop when they were putting in all the fancy stuff, said, you really ought to check with a guy named Doug Rao, who for 31 years worked at Trader Joe's, the last 14 as the president of the company. He happens to live in Newton, Massachusetts. And so I had lunch with him. And Trader Joe's is known, according to a story in, I think it was Fortune or Forbes, as the most secretive company in the world. And so this guy's retired. I figured, well, he'll spill the beans. It turns out they're not that secretive. They just don't participate in the retail social network at all. They're not in it. They don't go to the trade shows, any of that. So he explained to me how Trader Joe's work. This is a very short version of it. One is no gimmicks at all. They don't do any. They have the little fearless flyer, but that's an opt-in thing. But because the gimmicks, he says, have costs, discounting has costs. There are no discounts. They have no advertising. They have no loyalty cards. They don't do retail trade shows at all because, he says, they're all about capturing customers. Why do we go to that? You know, we don't need to know anything there. They never use the word consumer. They only use the word customer when talking about their customers. He says consumer is just a statistical category, and they consider it an insulting term. My friend Jerry Mikulski calls a consumer a gullet with wallets and wallets and eyeballs, you know, or a creature that lives only to gulp products and crap cash. That's the category that the rest of the industry looks at. And their marketing consists of talking to customers. That was his job as the president of the company, to go into the stores and talk to customers. He ran the company from his house, I think, in Newton, Mass., even though it's in Monrovia, California. And when I told him that we live in Santa Barbara, our official residence is in Santa Barbara, he said, which one do you shop at, the store on Milpus Avenue or the one near Upper State, the new one near Upper State? I said, how do you know that? He said, I've been in all the stores. They go in and they shop along with customers. They say, do you like that bag or that bag? He said, there's not a single thing inside Trader Joe's that is not influenced by customers. Their whole marketing is people there talking to the people who come in, which I never knew, but it's a counterexample to the earlier one, but because they don't participate in the retail social network that's busy trying to trap customers, most people don't know about it. So now let's get into what's actually going on and where the development opportunities are. There's actually an independence movement that's already going on. It's already happening. There's Luke Skywalker. In healthcare, there's electronic medical records, personal health records, quantified self stuff, people doing self-tracking, personal informatics, politics and governance. We all know about the Occupy movement, but there's a lot of other movements going on there. There's a rising concern about privacy and tracking. But the big one for me is something called VRM, for vendor relationship management. Do you all know about customer relationship management? Any of you familiar with CRM? A few of you? Customer relationship management is an $18 billion business that gives you junk mail and operates call centers. It's the thing that tells you to press 4 to stay on hold. That's what CRM does. They want to do better than that, but it actually doesn't work that well because it's one side talking. So VRM is the other side. VRM is a new category of tools and development on the customer side to deal with vendors, kind of the customer side counterpart of customer relationship management. So the VRM movement, though it predates that, especially in healthcare, started basically in 2006 when I got a fellowship at the Berkman Center. That's the Berkman Center at Harvard in an average winter, which we didn't have this year when nothing froze. But I started Project VRM there. And the purpose of that was to provide tools that make customers independent of vendors and be better able to engage with vendors and create instruments of personal intention. That was the idea. So, and what I wanted to do is just instigate the development. I saw it as my job to encourage companies and development communities to start working on fixing the market from the customer side rather than the seller side. Let's not make more cows. Let's not try to make the calves better for the cows. Let's help human beings hold up their end of whatever it is that the free market would be if everybody on the sell side wasn't busy trying to trap the customers. So with VRM, the customer drives. And so I'm going to give a few examples, and then I want to get into Q&A, because the category here is so large and broad, there's no single way to characterize all of it, except it provides independence and better means of engagement. So one is run your own personal cloud. That means keep your data in your own locker or vault or store. Put it to use in your own way. And these are some of the organizations doing this. Personal is actually here at the show. I don't know if there's anybody from Personal here in the crowd. There's one back there. Good. Going to talk you up. MyDex is in the UK. Azigo is in Boston. Singly is in Dubuque, Iowa, and San Francisco. The Customer's Voice is in the UK. Trust Fabric is in South Africa. There are a number of companies that are taking this on, working, fixing markets from the customer side. The second one, program the way your cloud interacts with the live web. This is Phil Windley on the left. He's the former CIO of Utah. He's a PhD computer scientist. He's created a company called Kinetics. He wrote a book called The Live Web. And this is one of his drawings. The point here is, and it's a little hard to see, that you have your own ability to program live the interactions that you have, do the if-then logic in the world without living in anybody's silo. You don't have to be inside Foursquare. You don't have to be inside Twitter. You don't have to be inside any particular company to use their APIs, to use your own API, to be able to say, for example, you know, if it's raining outside, this comes, or if I even using, say, Foursquare, you know, or Highlight, if so-and-so is within 3 blocks of me, let me know, without having to go inside any of those particular things. So basically, he's created the programming language and a rules engine, both open source, by which people can do this. And he makes an important distinction between the live web, which is the one of live interactivity, what this whole conference is about, interactive, from the static web of sites and locations and domains that you visit that we've had since 1995. A third is set your own terms of service. This is something a number of people have been working on, not only at Berkman and with our association with Harvard Law School, but in a number of other areas, where if you look at supply on one side, that's a magnet of, you know, this is the seller on this side. And that's the side that gives us what are called contracts of adhesion. These are the 55-page things you get from Apple on your iPhone that you click accept to, which on page 35 says, oh, by the way, we can change these terms anytime we want. Right? We're all signing these things all the time. They're pretty much unenforceable. They are definitely unconscionable. Those are two legal terms. But they are pro forma because we've jiggered the market in such a way that only the seller, only the supplier can provide the terms of service. But what if we could provide our own terms of service, and what if they were friendly? Would it be easier to navigate our way through the world that way? We can come into a place where, you know, say they're providing Wi-Fi, and all they want to know in the Wi-Fi, you know, except the terms is that you're not going to commit a terrorist act or steal anything. You can say, hey, I'm trustworthy. Here's somebody who will vouch for that. So you're on the demand side, and if you look inside that, that's a bit of browser Chrome. Those same two symbols are there. Those are ones that we've been working with. Those are UI elements. They are also in the public domain. Feel free to use them all you want. So, for example, you could say in your terms of service, don't track me outside your site or service. Give me my data in a usable form. Wipe my data when I say so. And here's my fourth party who can represent me. In the conversations within the VRM development community, the term fourth party has come up as a third party that's working for you as an individual. Some of these already exist. An insurance company does that, for example. A bank can do that. But all the companies I showed earlier can also be fourth parties that are working with you and for you on your behalf. And here's my trust network. A trust network is a network of people who, on their own, independently of any silo, have declared that I trust this person, say, as an accountant, or I trust that person as a photographer, I trust that person's credit. And to be able to scaffold a social association of people where anybody can rescind their particular trust for another individual, but where, in an organic way, from the ground up, we create our own trust networks outside of any cow that's trying to tell us how we ought to do it. Get full value from your digital assets. These are three entities that have been involved in this, in addition to the VRM community. The World Economic Forum last year produced a long document on personal data as an asset class. The Personal Data Ecosystem Consortium, and that's their URL, is a collection of some of the same companies that are involved in the VRM movement. And they've taken a lead in characterizing personal data as something that has value, that's not just sale value, it has use value. And this is something called a digital asset grid that a number of us, together with SWIFT, which is this big banking organization, have worked on, where, let's say you share data, you'd like to be able to track it. You'd like to be able to audit it later. You'd like to be able to follow where it went. So it isn't just, hey, Facebook, or hey, retailer, I'm sharing this data with you so you can give me better service, but rather, I'm going to follow it. And if you spill it against my terms, I'll know. Also, much the same way that you would track money, you can track data. So the summary is, free customers will always prove more valuable than captive ones in the long run. And toward that, I wrote a book that summarizes a lot of the work that's going on so far called The Intention Economy, in which my claim and my expectation is that an economy based on individual customer intention, what we mean to happen as individual customers, will prove more valuable than the attention economy right now, where a buttload of waste is committed trying to guess at what we want. We're wasting rods and cones in our eyes, we're wasting server cycles, we're wasting space on web pages and the rest of it. But when we're able to declare our own intent and manage our interactions, a new economy that will emerge that's based on a much more direct connection between what people want and get fulfilled. So that's from Harvard Business Review Press, and it's coming out on May 1st. But if you order from Amazon, you'll get it earlier than that. So, and these are two URLs and a hashtag that you can check out. ProjectVRM.org right now goes to the blog, but there's a click connection there to the wiki, which is pretty full of stuff. There's a long list of developers there that are involved with it. So with that on the screen, I'll just open this up for questions. Thank you very much. Down here, we have a mic that can come over to you. So.
Thanks for providing the presentation, and let me know about some of the new protections, I guess, that consumers can make for themselves. I was unaware of those. My question is about, you were saying free customers versus a customer that's paying. And one of the things you kind of didn't cover there, that's why I was kind of curious what your thoughts on this were. What I seem to notice, and also Professor Dan Ariely seems to notice to some degree, that sites that are free-based, websites that are based on a free model,
right,
that they may get a lot of signups, but the commitment of the customer is much less. So in other words, I could say I have 10 million users, but in actuality I only have, let's say, 2,000 that actually use the thing. They used it once and then they never used it again. Whereas a paid customer, well, there's a responsibility there on behalf of the customer, and they're going to keep coming back. So you wouldn't get your 2 million, but you get a lot less.
Let me, there's a lot there. Let me address a part of that. Any site where you're not paying for the goods, like, say, at Amazon, where you're getting a free service, like Google or Facebook or Twitter, it's important to make a distinction between a consumer and a customer here. Broadcasting had this problem, and it still does. Its customers and its consumers are different populations. The customers for Google and the customers for Facebook are advertisers. They're not you and me. I've been told by a high-up person at Google that they're not interested in doing paid direct for customer service. In other words, let's say you're on Google Plus, you want hand-holding, you're willing to pay $25 a month or something like that. They don't want to be in that business. They don't want to be in that business because they don't want to make less than $1 million a year per employee. That's what they want to do now. That's the way they're built. It's a fundamental conflict. It's a problem. It's a problem that Google has. It's a problem that Facebook has. It is not accountable to the user because the user is just a user. The user is not a customer. I think we have a real challenge coming up here with some of these companies because there's a disconnect between the customers and the consumers. And I worked in broadcasting years ago. It was a similar kind of thing. If you know, it didn't matter how much you liked a particular radio or TV station. If they felt like changing the format, they could do that because you're just a listener. You're not a customer. You're not paying for it. So it's an issue. And I'm not sure if that answers your question or not, but that distinction is an important one, and it's one we're going to face because these companies are basically working for advertisers and not working for customers. And when we obsolete the part of advertising that's pure guesswork, if demand can drive supply better than supply herds demand, it's going to be a different marketplace. Back over here.
How do you set the value for
For intention. Not attention, but intent. Like,
how do you set the value that you've been talking about, the value on that personal intention, that personal data that you are providing? Is it through a market, or how do you quantify that?
So what's the value of your intention when you walk into a car dealer? I think it doesn't matter as long as you can express it. I mean, right now, the the value is I'm not sure it's even measurable as in the old terms. It's just, you know, we just don't have the ability to express it right now. One interesting thing is that there's an assumption that because your data in the attention economy has value to all of the back-end aggregators and the advertising guys that are following you around, all the little dogs with the sniffy noses that are trying to keep up with you, that your data should have value if you sell it to marketers so they can guess better at you. I don't think there's much money in that, and I don't think there's much interest on people's part in that. I don't think people have much faith that if I dump my entire life history on you, you're going to be able to give me what I want when I want it. And I think one reason for that is, A, it's creepy, and B, we're not buying something all the time. That's a fundamental, it's not so much a flaw, but it's an assumption that prevails on the web as we're going around from place to place, that we are buying something at all times. And we're not. Most of the times we're not buying anything. We're just looking for stuff. But some cracks, and not so much cracks are starting to appear, but I don't know if you've noticed, but purely organic search results are getting buried further and further down below the commercial ones because the SEO is so good. But where the SEO is all around commercial activity, where they're trying to guess that you might want something now. But, you know, it's inherently a broken system, and it's going to get more broken over time. Others? Again, over here.
Just following on your argument that Google sees, or these large companies see, that the person that's using their service is a user and not the consumer, and doesn't that somewhat negate the argument? Doesn't that, in other words, if Google or some of these other larger companies see the people that use their services as users, not as customers, then doesn't that somewhat negate the entire need to personalize your own terms of service, because they're just going to steamroll over you anyway?
Well, not everything gets fixed all at once. You know, I think Google is a fabulous company. They're doing an amazing job. And I love the fact that Google gets the net probably better than any other large company out there. From the start, I think they've understood the net better than pretty much everybody else. They've done some noble lobbying on behalf of the internet, I think, against, say, phone companies. But they're providing a big pile of free services it's sort of fine as it stands, but, you know, the ability to assert our own terms of service should be an economic benefit for those who might listen to it. In other words, let's say that there's a market that could be formed by people who don't want to be tracked, right? By people who are willing to disclose, for example, that they are that their credit is good, or that their income is high, or that they can be trusted in one way or another, or that they're a serious customer. There's a whole category I didn't visit here, which is personal RFPs. A personal RFP is, I've arrived in Austin, I need a stroller for twins, I need it in the next 2 hours, I've got $200, who's coming through? Without having to go like a bee from flower to flower to flower, checking out all the different sites that might have a service there. Along with that could come terms of service that say, this is a one-time thing. Here's how you can trust me. Here's my fourth party with the credit stuff. I'm paying that fourth party for that. They may be bonded in some way. They may be my insurance company. They're already built to do that kind of work. I think we'll see a lot of established companies like banks and insurance companies getting involved in helping customers buy in their own ways much better than the web giants right now are trying to help customers, you know, are guessing at what customers might want here or there. Another is just the ability to change your data in other people's databases in one move. So one of the earliest pieces of work that we were doing in the VRM community is change of address. You know, I want to be able to change my address with many providers all at once rather than with, you know, having to go to each separate one and make that change. And that's that could also be in our terms of service, as it were. Like, you deal with me, I'm going to do this for you. Over here, yeah, here comes the mic.
First of all, thank you very much for the talk. I thought it was extremely interesting. My name's Steve. I build Microsoft's CRM product. And one of the things that we're doing a lot of thinking about is, what are those phenomenal customer experiences that you have, like your Trader Joe's, like your Zappos, like these businesses that really love their customers and talk about them as customers. So as I'm trying to put some of the things together that you're talking about. What could you help us understand, like, day in the life of what you think, you know, some of our consumer experiences today look like and where they might be going? Do you think, for example, that every grocery store would run like a Trader Joe's, or
I think we will leapfrog where Trader Joe's is now. So for example, as far as I know, Trader Joe's doesn't have a CRM system because they're not busy trying to know their customers by
right.
name and try
right.
to give them stuff. But for example, I would like to be able to tell Trader Joe's that I like those three things that I have there. Or I'd like to tell them, you know what, you guys have nothing but politically correct sausage. I'd like some actual pork sausage. I mean, they only have turkey sausage and chicken
yeah.
sausage.
Yeah.
You know, give me some actual pork sausage. You've got your own name brand hot sauce. I don't expect you to carry something that doesn't have your name on it, but something other than the one you've got. Or it might help you to know I like the Cholula, and we spent $4,200 on your store last year, because that's my data on this.
Yeah.
Now, the reciprocal on that, on the CRM side, is you're ready to hear that. You're
yeah.
building systems that are ready
yeah.
to hear that. We've seen VRM from the start as a reciprocal or counterpart for CRM. And the problem the CRM has had in the way that the market has been built is it's carrying the full load of both sides of the relationship. You know,
yeah.
it's saying, well, but selling these things separately in silos to all these different companies. And it's not just that this one has sugar and this one has Microsoft, this one has IBM, and that one has SAP, but rather that everything sold by those companies is different for all of the companies they sell it to, because they're trying to be not like all the other sellers. And yet the problem gets dumped on the customer of having all these separate relationships that are siloed and not very well informed by the customer. So what we're talking about is creating the means by which the customer can deliver much better information that they keep. I mean, it's, you know, if I'm busy keeping my healthcare data and I'm busy keeping my shopping data and my driving data and my traveling data and the rest of it, a lot of the reason I might want to share that or share it in general ways might be that I trust that Microsoft's CRM system is going to respect the things that I wish to keep secret, like that I have had a health issue or that I was out of a job for 6 months or some other thing like that. And I think that can only be done if there are systems on both sides that are trying to communicate, and we can start scaffolding genuine relationships rather than sort of the imaginary ones where the store is proxy for the customer inside a system that only has one side to it.
It sounds to me like you're...
Sorry?
It sounds to me it's almost you want to better institutionalize the voice of the customer.
Oh, absolutely.
To a business, right?
Yeah.
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 And just follow-up question to that, what do you think about, you know, ideation communities that My Starbucks or something like that?
No, I'm sorry, can I say that? The echo is so strong up here, I'm hearing... Yeah.
Thoughts on ideation communities and are those...
Ideation, you said?
If you go to My Starbucks, they have
okay.
a website where you can say, I want to get those little things that I put in my cup that stops it from spilling my coffee when I'm running down the street. And so they have this whole program of customers that can put ideas or complaints or
yeah.
do that in a transparent, open manner, and then they bring that in and they say, what are we going to change about what we're doing because of what our customers are telling us?
I think there's a lot in that in a lot of different ways. I think we will have a much richer and more interesting marketplace if the customer can say to, you know, have a dialogue with it. Let's say, like, I like Pete's Coffee. Pete's Coffee is, I like it a lot, right? I'm a coffee geek and I like their coffee. So, you know, I would like to be able to tell them, you know, I love the Garuda blend. I'm really glad you made the decaf Major Dickinson, but I like Garuda better. Give us a decaf Garuda, just letting you know. I also spent $2,000 last year with that. I also spent $1,500 on a coffee machine or whatever that is. And at the same time, hear from Pete's that, you know, we're doing this cool new thing you might be interested in because I have an affiliation with them. But there are things I'd like to be able to say to the whole marketplace as well. And also aggregate it together with others and say, you know, how many coffee geeks are there out here without having to go to coffeegeek.com or to, you know, wholelattelove.com, which are a couple of websites. They're wonderful, but why have to go there? Why couldn't I just advertise my interest to the whole marketplace? And in the Trader Joe's example, I don't want to have to wait for the president of the company by some chance to buttonhole me. You know, I'd rather, you know, or for the guy who's there, I'd rather just, you know, publish it in such a way that it would invite them to get a CRM system that will help them do what they're already doing in a more general way than they're doing now. I think there's an opportunity for that. over there, yeah.
Hi, Doc. I haven't seen the Swift thing before, and it occurred to me that they might be amenable to this because of European privacy law. Can you talk a little bit more about how that works for the second order and third order entities in that system?
Okay. What we did last year, and there were several efforts joined in that, the Kinetics people, Craig Burton, who was one of the fathers of Novell's success in the 80s, and others, got together with Swift to work on basically a prototype or an idea that for something they might be able to sell to banks as a service, as something banks could offer. European privacy laws didn't come up much, in part because the privacy issue is moot. It's moot if the user or the customer is in charge of their side of the privacy conversation. And they can say right up front, hey, you know, this is mine. We're tracking it. Here are the ways of auditing it. There's a standard called XDI that has something called link contracts. And with link contracts, you can track some of this stuff. I don't want to get too technical about it. But basically, it was a proof of concept that they're still working on. I'm not directly involved in it now because I'm not a programmer. But work is continuing forward on the digital asset grid, which is what that thing was called. Too complicated to describe, but the assumption is that if your data is an asset and that asset can be transferred and can be shared in a way that's governable by the source and agreed to by the destination and other third and fourth parties involved, lots of things can start happening around that, and banks and financial institutions can be in a business other than moving money. An interesting context there, by the way, is SWIFT is one of the organizations that says they don't move money. They just simply say $1 million disappeared from there and it appeared over there. And you can believe that because we have a rugged system for that. Money is just data. It's actually an opinion. It's an opinion by an organization that says it's not here, now it's over there. So if they could do that with data, it would be cool. Anybody else?
Hi there. Yeah, you mentioned a number of data vaults and lockers in your presentation. And then in questions, you voiced some skepticism around the idea of a marketplace for data. The idea of a marketplace for data, about monetizing personal data.
Yes, right. Skepticism on my part.
On your part, yeah. So could you speak a little bit about that? Is there a business model there? I don't have a horse in the race. I'm just curious.
There's a business fantasy there. I'm not sure it's a model. I think it's a fantasy because it's easy to imagine. You know, my data is valuable to these other people. It should be valuable to me. I'm giving it up. Maybe I should get something for that. That's the thinking that goes into it, but it's still inside that calf-cow model. It's like, as long as I'm a calf to all these cows, I should be able to sell my data to the cows. You know, we went through this with the open source world. I've been an editor for Linux Journal since the middle 90s. And I watched this happen with open source. You know, how can you sell this stuff? The interesting thing is it has use value, not sale value. Most of our personal data has extreme use value and very little sale value. But the use value of the data can have lots of economic effects. You know, if I can be a better customer, that has an economic effect. If I can share data that is, you know, useful to a company, you know, if I can help Microsoft CRM help Trader Joe's be a better company, that has economic effects. So to me, the ability to be a fully empowered customer requires me owning and controlling and having agency around my own data. And that is more important than being able to sell the data to a marketer who's going to guess about what I want, which is why I think that's a smaller market.
What you're describing sounds a little bit like the old-fashioned letters of credit. And about 2 years ago, which probably means it was 4 years ago, things move so fast, letters of credit broke down. You know,
it's so hard to hear what you're saying.
Okay, letters of credit, this sounds like what you're describing is letters of credit. You know,
Credit,
yeah. And yet, a couple years ago, letters of credit broke down and, you know, loads of Brazilian coffee beans just sat on the dock rotting because people didn't trust the letters of credit anymore. And so how does, you know, this system address, you know, who will trust, you know, how do you trust the trusters, you know, the people vouching, you know, the fourth parties in your words.
Right.
And what happens when that trust breaks down?
One of my theories is that everything is scaffolding. You know, there is no fully built out anything ever. You know, my next book, if I get around to it, will be about infrastructure. All infrastructure is reused. It's reused in some new way. You know, the railroads of yesterday become the bike trails of tomorrow, right? So I think that, we're at a real in-between point with banking and finance and money and the rest of it. Like, money is, it's like the Wile E. Coyote over the edge of the cliff, and hasn't occurred to us yet that this stuff actually is just data and has no intrinsic value other than the trust that we have in it. And so I think the trust itself becomes meaningful, and I think that there will be institutions that will figure out a way to make that work. My assumption is that having more customer involvement in that is going to make a difference. You know, so I mean, I'm a big fan of Liberty Mutual Insurance Company. They've done a lot of good things for us. You know, I was involved in an accident, or my wife was involved in an accident several years ago, where in a rental car, and Alamo just didn't care about us at all. The credit card company that we booked it with didn't care at all, even though it said so in their system that we'll take care of this. The insurance company said, we'll take care of it all. And we pay them. We pay them for that. And they have a system that allows us to do that. Visa, MasterCard, PayPal, those guys all have a place to play in here. One more, because I see we're getting attrition, so we're pretty much near the end of the hour.
So at the beginning you talk about the investments that have been made in the market.
What that have been made?
The investments that have been made in the market itself, right? So there's a lot of infrastructure, businesses that have been built around the current environment. And what's your perspective on what's required to reach a tipping point for the intention economy?
I think the closest thing I can think of it right now is that the ground is rumbling, and I don't know where the volcano is going to come up. I don't know what's going to break through. I pointed out there are five or six companies that are working with personal data right now. I think the biggest area is probably healthcare in the long run. But that I'd like to see solved in my lifetime, and I'm not sure I will, because the powers that be are so entrenched and the politics is so awful. But I think that I'm a great believer that inventions are the mother of necessity. You know, I did a bunch of work with Nokia and other phone companies before the iPhone and Android came out. They had the smartphone market completely locked down, and they knew what that looked like, and they knew it was going to happen 3 or 4 years from now, because they had their deals with the carriers, right? And then Apple comes along and blows the whole thing up with the iPhone, and suddenly everybody needs an iPhone, and then they need an Android because the old guys didn't control that market anymore. And an interesting thing, when we started Project VRM in 2006, it was a given that if anything required a user install, it was dead, you know, because user installs were like forbidden because they're too complicated. Now, how many apps do you have on your iPhone or your Android, right? We're doing user installs all over the place. People are much more willing, I don't know the numbers on it, people are much more willing to put add-ins in their browsers all over the place and customize in their browsers. Something in among those kind of things are going to break through, and there will be an invention that mothers a necessity here. I'm not sure what it's going to be. I wrote the book because I wanted to make sure that people knew what the groundswell was. But again, where the volcanoes break through, I don't know. I don't know yet. I wish I had a canonical example of what one would look like, but I don't. Not yet. That'll be it. Thank you.